Kia ora. Welcome to Aaron's Podcast, episode 247. Today is Wednesday, February 16, 2011. Today I have a bit more about New Zealand houses, a few things I forgot last time, a few things brought up in comments, and also that sort of relates to more of a personal update. And in case you're wondering, that is why today's episode is called Tomato Sauce, because tomato sauce is what I in America would call ketchup, and today's episode is a bit of a ketchup. I'm so funny. But the album art, if you happen to look at it, is of a plastic tomato, which is sort of a, what would you call it, a quintessential bit of Kiwiana. You see them in a lot of places, and they're used to hold tomato sauce, you know, so you can put it on the table. Every once in a while, you'll see it at an old-fashioned restaurant or somewhere in a small town or something. You don't see it in the big city so much anymore, but it is sort of quintessential Kiwiana. And I made sure I bought one some years back, well, a couple years ago, last year, whatever it was, I don't remember, because I never had one. But there's one slight problem. They don't hold very much. I mean, it's fine if you're like having a family barbecue and you just want to put it out so it looks nice. But to regularly hold it in the fridge, it doesn't work because it doesn't hold enough. We ended up getting a larger squeeze bottle from the plastic store instead, and which holds two refills rather than only a partial refill, which is what those little tomatoes hold. But that's what the name of this episode is about, and that's what the show art is about for this episode. But before I get into all of those catch-ups and updates and so on, I do have some items in the New Zealand news. First of all, today it was revealed that there was another death of a Kiwi soldier in Afghanistan. Private Kirifi Mila was the sixth New Zealand soldier to have been killed in Afghanistan. He died in an accident when his Humvee rolled on a 30-foot cliff, apparently, a 30-meter cliff. I'm not sure which it was. I'd have to look it up. And, yeah, so it's very sad. It is only although it's the sixth death of a New Zealander in Afghanistan, it's only the second of a New Zealander serving in the New Zealand military. We've had one in the British Army, two in the Australian forces, and there's actually a seventh one who's related to New Zealand, the nephew of Phil Goff, the leader of the New Zealand Labour Party, was serving in Afghanistan as a member of the U.S. Army, and he was killed back in 2007. So, so it's the sixth death, and it was a very sad thing to hear about today. But it also happened to come on the same day that Julia Gillard, the Prime Minister of Australia, was addressing the New Zealand Parliament, which is probably the big news story in New Zealand itself today. She arrived yesterday for a two-day visit, and today she became the first head of a foreign government to address the New Zealand Parliament. That's never happened before. So it was a sort of, a special event in itself. But I think she struck the perfect tone in her speech. She said, and this is a direct quote, "Australia has many alliances and friends around the world, but New Zealand alone is family." And she went on and she referred to the how both tragedies and war have brought the two countries together and how close they are to each other. And she obviously expressed her condolences and those of Australia for the recent death of the soldier. But she said that the tragedies as well as war reinforced our closeness. She was talking specifically about the Pike River mining tragedy, and she said, this is again a quote, "We didn't just mourn for the loss of the two Australians, we mourned for them all," which is certainly true from what I was able to see. And she added that, this is again a quote, "When the mine exploded, Australia didn't need to be asked to help. We just did. When natural disasters hit Australia this summer, New Zealand didn't need to be asked to help. They just did." And that sort of sums up in a nutshell what the true relationship between the two countries really is. New Zealanders and Australians love to make fun of each other, sometimes bitterly. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And they are bitter rivals on the sports field as well. And never let it be said that that's all fake, because it isn't. But when it comes right down to it, the two countries are closer than I think I've ever seen two countries be without actually being part of the same nation. The only countries that I can think of that are more closely bound together are the countries of the United Kingdom. And, of course, they're actually in one nation, whereas we're two separate nations. Now, part of the purpose of her visit here was to encourage even further integration between the two countries. 30 years ago, roughly, New Zealand and Australia signed the Closer Economic Relations Agreement, or CER as we call it, and I've mentioned that before. And the idea was to make it easier to do business on both sides of the Tasman so that Australian companies would have an easier time in New Zealand and vice versa. Well, now the move is toward more what amounts to essentially a Australasian common market, a single unified market in both countries. Now, this is, let me stress, this is a long way away. I would guess at least 20 years before this can happen, partly because the regulation for the business regulations in the two sides of the Tasman are very different. In the wake of the global financial meltdown, Australia put through a lot of regulations on reporting and transparency and those sorts of things, which business, of course, hates, as they do. But it is very different from our regulations. And so things like that have to be ironed out. And so it's not just a simple matter of saying, yeah, let's form a common market. There are a lot of really intimate and minute details that have to be sorted out for that to happen. The general speculation is at some stage there will be a common market between the two countries, possibly as part of a larger Pan-Pacific common market, which would be bigger than Europe ultimately, although not necessarily in terms of population. But that would be a very long time away, and there's a lot of political hurdles to overcome, and I have reservations about that, which I can talk about another time. But it has to do with economic sovereignty primarily. But I do think it may be closer, it may be sooner rather than later, that the two countries adopt a common currency. And there's been talk about this off and on for years, and I think I've probably mentioned that in the past. But the business leaders on both sides of the Tasman really want it in order to make payments easier and all those sorts of things. It would also make it easier for Australians to take their profits back home. There wouldn't be any currency conversion charges. But I don't know. I don't think that that's going to happen anytime soon either. Now, this was an historic day in that she was the first head of a foreign government to address the New Zealand Parliament. But it wasn't actually a sitting of Parliament. It was a special session. And the reason is that the Green Party objected to allowing a foreign leader to address a sitting of Parliament because it would set what they called a precedent, which I frankly find absurd because Parliament can do whatever it likes or not. It's not obligated to ever invite another foreign leader to speak to them just because they have this one time. However, I do actually think it's a good idea for them to bring foreign leaders in because most legislatures in the world do that. The U.S. Congress does it all the time. Australian Parliament has done it. It's not an uncommon thing to do. Nevertheless, it is the first, a first for New Zealand. But there's a backstory to this, and I don't believe I've talked about this on the podcast before. I'd have to go back and listen, which I'm certainly not going to do right now. But last year, the Chinese vice president was visiting New Zealand, and the leader of the Green Party, of the Green Party, Russell Norman, was assaulted on the steps of Parliament by security thugs who were accompanying the Chinese vice president. At the time, Norman was protesting China's occupation of Tibet, and he was holding up a Tibetan flag. And Chinese security thugs snatched the flag out of Norman's hands, but that was after they first tried to shield it from view with an umbrella. Now, in New Zealand, members of Parliament have the right to go anywhere on Parliament grounds without restriction, which meant that he was able to get really close to this guy. They staged his arrival at Parliament, which is why he was there. And it was, in retrospect, probably a very bad choice of an event, a venue for an event, if they were trying to make the Chinese feel better. Because the Chinese have a long history of, have a very troubled history with New Zealand when it comes to democratic protests. Because, of course, you can't do that in China itself. But here, of course, anybody can protest anytime they want. When a Chinese leader visited New Zealand during the time when Jenny Shipley was prime minister, they parked buses to block the view to the state dinner that they were holding that night. And I think they revved the engines or something to drown out the protesters too, if memory serves, because they wanted to shield the Chinese leader from having to be confronted by, well, democracy, basically. And in the past, there have been issues with the Chinese government refusing to allow certain journalists to attend press conferences because they said that they were part of Falun Gong, which is, as you may know, the Chinese government classifies as a terrorist organization, which most people in the West think is a bit absurd, but that's where they're at. They're a bit overly sensitive on any dissent, of course. And then, of course, there was this incident as well. So we've had a checkered relationship with the Chinese government when it comes to New Zealanders expressing their democratic rights, which, of course, Chinese people aren't allowed to do. And so that's the backstory to this. And what I think the Greens were really about is they didn't want to set a precedent where they would have where the leader of China would be allowed to speak to Parliament. And the Prime Minister, in fact, didn't mention the leader of China when he was talking about how others might be invited, like the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of the UK, or senior European officials. He did not mention China, which is the obvious one, because after Australia, China is our second biggest trading partner. So, you know, it was a bit, I don't want to say dishonest exactly, but it was an odd omission on the part of the Prime Minister. So it was an historic day. There's a backstory to the little protest and how it ended up being a special sitting, a special session, and not a actual sitting of Parliament. And it's been very strange. But from here on out, when I talk about New Zealand politics, it's probably going to be in the context of the election. And today, of course, is no different. And I actually have a new election Watch intro, which I'll play now. Election Watch 2011.
Mr. Speaker!
Yes, it is election year here in New Zealand, and of course, pretty much everything I say about the government here on out is going to be against this backdrop of this looming election. And part of that is because the politicians are going to be saying things specifically with an eye toward their election or re-election or whatever it is that they hope to achieve. So, as the case may be. So you have to kind of take it all with a grain of salt, I guess. But that's where we're at. It is now election season, and pretty much anything that any politician says is geared toward the campaign, is part of campaigning. And I have to say that this whole campaigning business began in the bizarre and the banal when the Prime Minister decided he was going to start talking to more media outlets than he usually does, and he appeared on the sports radio show for a guy named Tony Veitch. Now, Tony Veitch became famous when it was alleged and ultimately proven that he assaulted his partner. He pushed her down the stairs and kicked her several times and broke her spine and was convicted. And he was he lost his job with TVNZ and with Sport Radio. But he's now back on Sport Radio doing his show. And the Prime Minister was on there, and they got on the discussion of whether or not Liz Hurley is hot. Now, quite apart from the inappropriateness of Tony Veitch discussing such things, the ickiness at the very least, it just seemed grossly inappropriate to be talking about, for the Prime Minister to be talking in that way. It's certainly undignified, but just it was icky. And so that created a whole conversation for several days. And then all of a sudden, the leader of the opposition, Phil Goff, shows up having dyed his hair. And then that became a topic of conversation. And then the leader of the opposition also said that he thought Liz Hurley was hot too. Isn't that good to know? And then there was a poll taken on, I think it was Stuff or some one of the websites, about who was hotter, Phil Goff or John Key. And it just was just an awful, awful time to be listening to this stuff, because we've got this election looming. The National Party is promising to sell off state-owned assets. Oh, sorry, partially privatize. And we've got other important issues coming up, the state of the economy. And what are they talking about? Whether or not Liz Hurley is hot? Which of the two main leaders is hot? I mean, come on. It was just awful. Well, things have moved on slightly since then. The current controversy is over the national government buying 34 top-of-the-line BMW luxury cars to use as would chauffeur around VIPs and also ministers, which isn't often talked about, at a cost of some $3 million or something like that. These are cars that are not even available in New Zealand. And I think it's the 750 or 730 or something like that. I don't remember. Anyway, the point is that they're about $200,000 each. And there's two problems with this. And I'm going to be posting a post on my blog about this probably by the time you hear this or not long after. The two problems are that the government is on this austerity kick. They're telling people that the government needs to cut back. They need to cut funding for various programs. They need to eliminate things. They need to fire a whole bunch of workers from the public service, all this sort of stuff. And then they go and spend $3 to $4 million on new cars. The ones that are replacing, by the way, are 3 years old. And so the deputy prime minister, who's also the finance minister, Bill English, said, first of all, oh, well, labor signed the contract and we're just following through. That is absolutely not true. They did sign a contract, but the renewal this year was optional. It wasn't mandatory, and the national government decided to go ahead and spend millions of dollars on cars anyway. If they are going to push this austerity thing on ordinary New Zealanders, they should be leading by example, and they should have said, we're going to keep these cars for another couple of years. Or they could have gotten cars that were a fraction of the cost. I mean, like a Lexus, for example. A comparable Lexus is a fraction of the cost of these stupid BMWs, which aren't even available in New Zealand. It just looked like more of the of what we call the born-to-rule attitude among national, that they feel they deserve all of this stuff because they are the natural party of government, which to anyone who's not a National Party supporter is just laughably absurd. But there is a real undercurrent of that among many national supporters. And buying $3 million worth of luxury cars during a recession when the economy is still hurting, and ordinary New Zealanders are hurting, and they're preaching to us that we have to tighten our belts collectively and individually, it smacks of let them eat cake. So that's the latest thing that just blew up today, in the past couple days, I should say. And it is not a good look. But there was also another issue that came up over the weekend. The Prime Minister, John Key, went to the Big Gay Out, which is Auckland's biggest GLBT event. I'm sure it's the biggest event of the year. The Big Gay Out is a sort of a play on words for an event that's held at the beginning of summer called the Big Day Out, which is a music event that's held at a local sports stadium. And lots of acts go, and it's a long day, and blah, 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 blah. So that's where the name comes from. It was originally part of the Hero Festival, well, it might still be if that still exists, which included the parade, or sort of a successor. And it still exists, and it's apparently a very good time. I've never been because it's always very hot. It was a record hot day that day this year. And also, quite frankly, I've never felt good enough about the way I look to go because... yeah, you know, they're just, it intimidates me, that sort of thing. But anyway, one of the hazards of attending that event is you do have to listen to politicians' speeches. Phil Goff, the leader of the Labour Party, addressed the crowd and basically reminded them of what they had done, enacting civil unions and other bits and pieces like that. And then John Key spoke to the crowd. He said that the National Party under him had a strong record of standing up for gay rights. And you would think to yourself, oh, great, what did they do? What's the evidence of the strong record? And this is a direct quote from John Key. Quote, I promised not to roll back gay rights, and I have kept my promise. Close quote. Now, I'm sorry, but not doing bad things is not the same as doing good things. It's not a strong record on gay rights. And I said on my blog, and I'll post a link in the show notes, I said on my blog that... it wasn't so much they had a strong record of standing up for gay rights, they had a strong record of sitting down for gay rights. But the National Caucus has a really anti-gay record. The Civil Unions Act was passed in December of 2004, and at the time there were 27 members of the National Party in Parliament, 27 national MPs. 24 of those 27 voted against the Civil Unions Bill, including John Key. And 14 of those MPs who voted against the Civil Unions Act are now in John Key's cabinet. Now, the only three national MPs who voted for the bill are now gone from Parliament. Now, the following March, this was 2005 now, Parliament was considering the Relationships Statutory References Bill, and the purpose of that was to essentially put legal force behind the Civil Unions Act, as it was by then, by changing the references in law to couples to include people in civil unions. So it wasn't just marriage, for instance. I should say most laws, because adoption law wasn't covered in that. During the debate, there was a MP from the ACT Party, again the ACT Party, named Stephen Franks, and he offered a two-part amendment, and it's supposedly on libertarian grounds. The first part would have removed sexual orientation and marital status and family status from the Human Rights Act, which would have meant removing all the legal protections that, in this case, gay people enjoy. The second part would have specifically allowed anyone except the government to discriminate because of specific conduct. And the conduct, and this is a quote, the conduct was extramarital sex, extramarital childbearing, in other words, child out of wedlock, the breach of promises exchanged in marriage, adultery, desertion, same-sex relationships in the nature of marriage, and homosexual sex. So in other words, anybody who did any of those things could be fired or not been able to have a job. They could have been refused accommodation at a hotel, any number of things, in contravention of the Human Rights Act as it is now. Now, I personally found that reprehensible and disgusting that he would do that, and he can try to justify it on libertarian grounds all he wants, but it was a really shitty thing to try to do. But three current National Party cabinet ministers, Judith Collins, John Carter, and Nick Smith, all voted in favor of specifically legalizing discrimination. Now, of course, the amendment ultimately failed, but the point is still the same. You've got three cabinet ministers who went out of their way to kick gay people in the gonads. In December of 2005, there was another bill before Parliament by an ex-MP. His name was Gordon Copeland, and he was part of the right-wing United Future Party. He was one of the Christians in it. And he had a bill that was called the Marriage Gender Clarification Amendment Bill, and it would have defined marriage as only between one man and one woman. But this was, of course, absurd because the courts had already established that the Marriage Act referred only to one man and one woman. 36. This is, of course, after an election. So 36. There were 36 national MPs in the parliament at the time who voted for it. And of them, 15 are now in cabinet. So, I mean, at the very least, you can say that a good chunk of John Key's cabinet has an anti-gay voting records. And sometimes, at least in the case of those three ministers, pretty virulently anti-gay. So, as I said in my blog, and this is quoting myself now, pardon me for not being thrilled with John Key that he's kept them from repealing what Labour enacted when it was in government. John Key's government has no record on gay and lesbian rights, good, bad, or indifferent, except if you want to give him a backhanded compliment to say he didn't make things any worse. And that's nothing to be proud of. That's not a record to run on. So when he made this plea for GLBT voters to consider voting for national in the next election, I thought he had an awful lot of cheek to do that when his government has done nothing. And many of his caucus mates and many of his ministers in government actually tried to keep things bad for GLBT New Zealanders. Now, I said before that I was going to talk about my journey in deciding who to vote for in the upcoming election. And I'm still going to be doing some of that anyway. But I can tell you now that there is no way in hell I'm giving my party vote to the National Party. It ain't going to happen. It never has. It certainly won't this year. In a future year, I don't know. It's impossible to say what's going to happen in the future. But this government is dishonest. This government has been a disaster. And there's no way in hell I'm going to vote to keep it in office. Now, that still leaves open the question of who I'm going to vote for my local MP and ultimately who I'm going to give my party vote to. But I can guarantee you that the National Party will not get my party vote. So that's what's been going on this week in the campaign trail, and that also is what's been going on in the news. So now I'm going to switch gears, and I'm going to talk about some of the things that I didn't talk about last time, which was about New Zealand houses. There's a couple of things I didn't mention, mostly because I didn't think of it. One of them, I talked about housing construction a little bit and stuff like that. But one of the things I didn't, and I also said that windows, I think I said that windows typically are single glazed. But one of the things I didn't mention is that typically windows don't have screens on them, or as most people in New Zealand call them, fly screens. And I don't actually know why that is. I don't think there's a particular reason. Now, older houses may have the double-hung windows that a lot of us are used to, where you raise the sash to open the window, and it's very easy to put screens on those. But newer houses in New Zealand, and when I say newer, certainly from the 1970s onward, maybe even a bit earlier, have aluminium windows. We call it aluminium joinery. And the windows swing out in I think they call it canopy style or something, which is good because it helps keep the rain from coming in when it's rainy, and it does rain a lot. But it makes it very difficult to fit those sorts of windows with screens. Now, we've lived in a couple of houses that actually had at least some screens fitted. And there's a couple ways they did it. In some houses, they had ones that slid in a track over, and you just slid it in front of the window when it was open, because otherwise, with it closed, the handles would block it. And then we had others that were hinged at the top of the window. You open the window out and then push the screen down and latch it into place. But that was really rare. And our current house has no screens whatsoever. And our previous house, which was in Pāroa, and had It had a variety of windows because it was built in 1950 and added on to in the 1970s. It had no window screens either, which is really bad in the country because, as you can imagine, in a dairy farming area, flies can be particularly bad. But it was very common. And it was one of the first things that struck me about New Zealand houses when I came here, apart from being cold that first year, was that there were no screens on the windows. Now, in America, of course, I took it for granted that there would be screens on the windows because there almost always were, but not here. And I did forget to mention that before. Now, one of the other things that I didn't talk about a whole lot, that I didn't talk about really, was about the whole way that taxation works on property in New Zealand. It's very different from Illinois, where I'm from, and probably quite a few other states. In Illinois, property value was determined in part on what was called the highest and best use of land, which meant in part that it had to be similar to the land around it. So, for example, if you're in an area that's all high-rises, but you've got one little plot of land, your lot, as we called it in Illinois, and it just had a house on it, you would be taxed on that property for the same rate as your high-rise neighbors because the highest and best use of that land would be to have high-rises on it. Here in New Zealand, it doesn't work that way. Land is assessed based, first of all, on the value of the land itself, which is very often the smallest component of the entire property, of the value of the property. And then there's a second quotation that's put on there for the value of what are called the capital value, which is all the stuff that is on the property, the dwelling, garage, paving, drainage, all those kinds of things are taken into account. It's all put together, and that gives you what we call quotable value, or QV. It used to be called the government valuation, or GV, but that was replaced some years back. So that is what the value of the property is based on. And what we call rates, which are similar to property taxes, are based on that total value. But it isn't based on this concept of highest and best use of land, but rather on the value of that land as assessed in a more or less dispassionate sort of way. And it is possible that a property that is in a bunch of high-rises but doesn't have a high-rise on it would have much lower taxes than an equivalent property, at least in Illinois, would. And I don't know what other states do, but certainly the way the taxes are calculated in New Zealand are very different from what we had in Chicago. But to talk about this more, I am going to go on now to the comments. And actually, before I go into the comments, I'm going to start with a phone comment.
Hi, Arthur. I'm back in Albany. This is Roger. And so somebody may have already called you, so this may be redundant. But in case it isn't, this is your call for the month. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, Roger. And, of course, Roger has been a frequent contributor to this podcast. Well, both my podcasts, actually, and my blog. And he recently suffered a personal tragedy when his mother passed away. And he's blogged movingly about all of that. And so I, of course, extend my condolences to Roger through this podcast. But one of the reasons I wanted to start with a phone message is that I also received a phone message from Kyle in Hawaii, who asked me not to play it, ultimately. But he raised some interesting topics. He talked about alternative housing construction methods. And the short answer is that it's available, but not everywhere. Most construction in cities has to be consistent with what's around it. So if it's traditional houses, you're going to end up having to build a traditional house or you won't get approval to build. Now, in other areas of the country, particularly if you've got a block of land, you can get away with more unconventional techniques. And I've seen houses that have been built from straw bales, bales of hay, and some that have been built from rammed earth, some that have been built from used tires, some that have been built from bottles. Glass bottles, of all things, at least partially, and similar things. And then, there are others that are built out of using recycled materials. And that you might be able to get away with in a city. But apart from that, you really can't get away with anything other than very traditional construction techniques within an urban area, or probably even in a town. Out in the country, as I say, you can do more of what you want. But you can still add quite a lot of other things which may not necessarily be so conventional from some people's perspective. For instance, it's quite common to have a solar hot water heater on the roof of houses around here, and that's actually a really good thing because domestic hot water heating takes up roughly 40% of New Zealand's entire electricity usage. So anything we can do to lighten the load would be a good thing. Increasingly, you see people putting photovoltaic cells on the roof to do one thing or another, in some cases to power a whole house, although that's expensive, or perhaps to just power certain things, like maybe a freezer in the garage, because those are really energy inefficient. And if you can power it through an alternative source, that changes the equation quite a bit. And it is also common for people to have solar-powered, I should say solar accessories, like chargers for phones and other devices that have to be charged up. And a lot of people use solar-powered garden lights nowadays too, which isn't as much of a savings as you might think, not just because garden lights are very low voltage, but also because a lot of people use them where they wouldn't normally use lights at all because they'd have to run the wires and all that sort of stuff, and it's a hassle. But so some of these techniques are starting to work their way into standard houses, and passive solar design is something that certainly is used where it can be. There are some sites that just aren't really suitable for siting for the sun because of, I don't know, the direction the section faces or whatever. But those sorts of things are being used. And of course, as I said before, increased insulation and increasingly double or even triple glazed windows. But alternative construction techniques as such are not, you generally won't see those in a city except in very unusual circumstances. And of course, when I say city, I mean that in the New Zealand sense where it's this larger area. Of course, now Auckland is one city, but it used to be a lot of several different ones. And a lot of the residential areas in these cities would be more like a suburb in American sense, in that their houses are isolated in blocks of land. A typical section in New Zealand is a quarter acre, or used to be. It isn't so much anymore. It's now maybe a third of an acre. And but they used to be quite large. And oddly enough, people didn't raise vegetables very often in this big block of land, although even that's becoming popular nowadays, but because of economic reasons more than anything else. So Kyle was basically talking about some of these alternative construction techniques, and I just wanted to pick up on that and say that, that's my chair squeaking, saying that some of these things are available, but usually outside of a major city. Now, over in the written comments, Tim Carmel said, and he's the host of the Tim Carmel Show, which I highly recommend, he said, the D.C. area switched over to heat pumps in new construction and renovations in the 1970s due to a lot of lobbying money being poured into the industry developers. When our building, which was built in 1865, was renovated in 1980 and turned into a four-unit condo building from the original 5,000-square-foot single-family home, they removed the natural gas lines from the building and installed heat pumps. Unfortunately, the D.C. area is just on the line of winter-slash-summer temperatures where heat pumps are really effective, and as a result, they don't work so well. Don't work so well here during the extreme temperatures. My last electric bill was over $400 to keep the house at a comfortable temperature of 70 degrees. I looked at having gas put back into the building, but it would have cost over $5,000 to tear up the street and sidewalk to run the gas lines into the house and also require tearing out drywall and lots of piping installation, including venting a furnace outside to the back of the building. So we're all kind of stuck and just live with what we have. Me again. Interesting about the gas line thing, because it's been since I've been in New Zealand that they've started running piped gas through the streets, and it sort of lost steam, as it were, some years back. I don't really know why. Gas is available up on our street, but the street is, what would it be, 500 meters uphill from our house, maybe more than that. They will come down, I think it's 20 meters or 40 meters or something like that from the street, and that's as far as they'll go for free. After that, you've got to pay the rest of the distance, and it would have cost many thousands of dollars, although we would have gotten a better price if we'd gotten another house to sign up for it. And when I say better price, I'm saying we would have saved some. So naturally, we didn't do that. Now, we, as I've said before, we did have a gas, furnace in American terms, and we have a gas hob or stove, and we have gas hot water. And the way that's done is we have two 45-kilogram tanks which hold LPG, which in America is called propane. And that's what heats our water and provides the gas for cooking. For the stove, the oven is electric. And that's, well, I wouldn't say it's unusual. It's not common to do that sort of thing. It's the first house I've lived in that's had gas. But the gas hot water heaters are always mounted on the outside of the house. It's attached to the side of the house. The gas lines come up to it, and the hot water pipes go back out and under the house and so on. And although I've seen some of that in some of the more temperate climates in the U.S. as well, the thing you have to remember here is that pipes don't freeze. It never gets cold enough for pipes to freeze. So even if you're not running the hot water, you don't have any risk that that's going to happen. And by mounting it to the side of the house on the outside, that means that there's obviously no venting because it's completely outside. And they're obviously designed for this, so it's not like it's an unusual usage for it. But electric hot water heaters are obviously, maybe not obviously, but they are always inside the house, and they're in a closet, which is usually called the hot water cupboard. And typically, you'll also have shelves in there where you put your linens, your towels, and your sheets, and so on. And because the hot water cylinder is always a little bit warm, it keeps that cupboard warm and dry, and helps keep your linens fresh, supposedly, anyway. And most houses have that sort of thing. Our house has that cupboard, but it doesn't have the hot water cylinder in it because it was removed when the gas hot water was put in instead. But gas for heat, pipe gas for heat, is really rare. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head who has gas forced air heat apart from this house. Although it could, I admit, I just may not know that they have it because, I mean, Most people don't go around talking about their heating methods, but gas is relatively rare, and of course it's running out, and so there's been a bit of a reluctance to, I don't know, invest in that, I suppose, and heat pumps instead have become much more popular. And of course, roughly at least 2/3 of our power comes from renewable resources, hydropower, geothermal, even wind, those sorts of things. So it's not as much of a burden on the environment as even natural gas is, potentially, because it's renewable. There's no production of greenhouse gases in either the geothermal or the hydropower. And so in those senses, electricity can actually be better for the environment than running natural gas. Next up, Calvin said, interesting regarding heat. We don't use heating. Well, I have an electric blanket, and we have a couple oil space heaters, which I get angry if JR uses. Wasteful. So we're mostly at the mercy of the weather. Actually, tons of businesses don't have heating or air conditioning here. There are houses. Are the houses you're looking at more pedestrian friendly, so you could walk more? Although the hills can be good for views and stairways, walks are something I like. Thanks, Calvin. Oh, and thanks, Tim. I forgot to thank you. Well, yeah. First of all, I don't like the oil space heaters either because they are very wasteful. They're not as bad as the, what do you call those things? They've got a fan heaters, we call them. Just an electric coil with a fan that blow the air around. They're even worse. But we don't have any. We have one, actually. We still do have one, but it's out in the garage. We don't use it for anything. It's just stored there. And I looked at it the other day and thought, we really have to get rid of that thing because we don't have any use for it. So anyway, most businesses, well, I take that back. As I say, most businesses are at least heated. That's not necessarily true. You can find any number of places, including cafes, that have no heat or air conditioning at all. And it just whatever the ambient temperature is what they end up being. Of course, in the case of a cafe, they probably have a kitchen, so that contributes heat to the place. But it's not common for these sorts of places to be heated or air conditioned. It's more common now than it used to be for houses to be, not just houses, but businesses to be air conditioned. And people are beginning to expect that because our summers are getting hotter. And as that trend continues, I think it'll eventually become universal. Even these small little cafes that have held out will end up installing air conditioning because they won't be able to compete with those that are air conditioned, essentially. Now, onto the other subject about the houses that we're looking at. There's no simple answer to that because there are some houses that we've looked at that are not necessarily in a flatter area because most of North Shore City, well, it used to be called North Shore City, most of the North Shore where we live is not flat. Most of it is very hilly, but some of it is closer to shops and things like that, so that we could theoretically walk more. Where we live now, there are no stores anywhere nearby here. You'd have to walk. There's a, what we call it, a dairy. It's like a little superette down the road. It's about a 10-minute walk downhill and then realistically a 15-minute walk uphill or more to come home. But it's, those stores are very expensive, and it's the sort of place you would go to because you just ran out of milk or you just ran out of eggs or something. And it's not the kind of place you would go to do shopping. And it's sort of like a, I don't know, like a 7-Eleven or something in that sense, although it's much more folksy than that. And there are no shops anywhere within walking distance other than that. The next nearest block of shops would be easily from here, probably realistically a 30-minute walk, although it's, a car could do it in 5 minutes, but because it's all uphill, steep hills, long hills. And the nearest supermarket would be probably about an hour's walk, I would guess, for much of the same reason, because most of it's uphill. And there's very little bus service, certainly in our area, and certainly not off-peak hours, like, say, not rush hours. And so there aren't a whole lot of options. Now, if you live in the city itself, in the CBD, or near the CBD, or actually in it, then your choices are much different because there are a lot of apartments there and it's much flatter. So the opportunities to walk are much greater. But we're not looking there because we've now got three animals. So we can't move into one of those apartments. Tempting though they are sometimes. but it brings up the larger subject of where we're looking and what we're looking at and all those sorts of things. And this is a difficult thing. We don't know what we're doing. And let me rephrase that. Well, we probably don't. We don't know what we're going to do. Last week, we met with an architect who works with a firm that specializes in home renovations and so on. And the idea was that we would build onto the back of the house, and we would build what New Zealanders would call a granny flat. And it's called that because it's the sort of place that, you know, you set up so that when granny needs a place to stay, she can come and stay there. And it's not legal to rent them out as accommodation, although people do. And they are not separate. Now, we found out all sorts of things we didn't know about these granny flats. They're quite common in New Zealand. I mean, not every house has one, certainly. But it's not uncommon to see it in the real estate ads, for instance. But we found out that the councils like them to be actually more or less separate buildings, with the idea that if they change their mind later, they can order you to remove it, and it won't be a big hassle as opposed to something that's integrated into the structure. If you include a small kitchen, then that becomes a problem because they see that as you're trying to increase the population density or whatever you call it, residential density or whatever of your property, and they don't like that because that puts more strain on sewerage and other things. And the easiest way to get it approved by council is to say you're just adding on, and then you probably don't put a kitchen in it, or if you do, you move the kitchen from the main house into the addition. And so you only have one kitchen, and then it's much easier to get approved, which I thought was fascinating in itself. But the fees for the architect were $10,000 to get to the point where then the construction company can quote on the actual building. And that's just not going to happen. We are not going to spend $10,000 on something that we ultimately may not even do or may not be able to get financed to do. So it's just, it's a non-starter. So we're again back to the drawing board, reconsidering our options. We're looking at what we could do to this house to make this house more livable with as it is now, which would primarily mean installing more storage. I was looking in the loft space above the garage yesterday, sweating bullets because it's so hot up there, to see how we might be able to put some shelving of some sort up there. That's not shelving, it's more like flooring, so we can accommodate more boxes. And because there's certain things that you have to keep the boxes for, and then there's also luggage and things like that. But you can't put anything up there because some things will melt in the heat. So I was looking how that could be done. And then, of course, under the house, they make these special racks that attach to, well, in this case, the floor joists. And so you can hang things there that's up off the ground, but there's a lot of air moving around, so it's not a problem with dampness and things. So I was thinking about stuff like that, and then we're talking about repainting and recarpeting and maybe making some other changes here and there that we've talked about doing and making this house more livable as it is, and then revisiting down the road what we're going to do, if we're going to do something in the back of the house or if we're going to move or what. And I don't know. That doesn't mean we're not going to continue to look for houses, but it means that at the moment that's all on hold. Because part of the problem is that because of the changes in interest rates, we've suddenly managed to pay off a bunch of the mortgage, which is good because it means we've got more equity. But it also means if we stay where we're at, in I think it's 10 years, 12 years, something like that, the house will be completely paid off. Whereas if we move, then, you know, it's almost like starting over again. So I have no idea what we're going to do. This is going to be an ongoing story, and I'll probably end up coming back to it. But sort of getting back to what Calvin was asking, I would prefer to live in a flatter area. When we lived in Pyro, although there were hills, we were able to walk every morning because most of the town is flat. And so we had this nice half an hour walk we did every morning, and helped with weight, I can tell you. And we don't have anything like that here. If you want to go walking in a nice flat area, you've got to drive to it. There just is no alternative. And but by the same token, we can't restrict ourselves just to flat areas because they tend to be expensive, by and large, and not necessarily where we want to live. So, this is a story in development, and I'll come back to that, I'm sure, in the weeks ahead. But at this point, we have no idea what we're going to do. That's the way it is. And the next comment is from Tracy in Chicago, who says, "Hey, Arthur, I love hearing your voice on your podcast. I always told you that you have an announcer's voice, and there's always been a radio and news person inside of you." A smiley face. "Well, I miss you in Chicago, and I'm sorry I missed your birthday. So happy belated birthday. Keep up the great work podcasting. Reed says hi." And Tracy and I, of course, go way back. And Tracy is appears occasionally on the Feast of Fun podcast. So you may know her from that. And we actually have a very deep personal history. And sometime I might actually talk about that, but I like to keep a few mysteries around. And but if you listen to the Feast of Fun, you probably already know about it. And the next comment was from Lord Byron, who said, "Do you have whole house heat pumps? When I lived in Springfield, Illinois, my two-bedroom townhouse had a heat pump. It had an auxiliary feature that would help in very cold weather. We had a municipal power company with lower rates, and my bill usually ran about $50 a month from September through April. I never heard of one-room heat pumps until I heard your podcast." Thank you, Your Lordship. Oh, thanks, Tracy. I forgot to thank you. And this actually kind of gets back to what Tim was talking about earlier. Heat pumps can be problematic in a place like New Zealand, which has very different climates. There are certain machines that can't be sold in parts of the South Island, for instance, because it gets too cold and they don't work efficiently, kind of like Tim was talking about. And you can't sell them at all in Rotorua because the geothermal gases corrode the mechanisms and destroy them very quickly. What is that gas called? I can't remember. It's the rotten egg smell. And it's just hydrogen sulfide, I think it is. Oh, somebody will correct me, I'm sure. Anyway, getting back to the question, though, whole house heat pumps are extremely rare in New Zealand, as far as I can tell. Our house was ducted already because of that gas heating system, so it's relatively simple to switch to a heat pump system instead. But it is far more common to have a one-room or maybe two-room unit. And the way it works is you've got the compressor that sits outside, just like a normal one, but it's looks like a big suitcase, essentially, maybe a bit taller and bigger, but I mean, that's kind of what it reminds me of. And it has the pipes and so on, then run into the house through the wall, and the actual unit that is the air exchanger and the fans and all that sits on the wall up about 30 centimeters or so down from the ceiling, you know, about a foot down from the ceiling, well, a bit more than that, I suppose. And it has a remote control, so you can control it without getting up close to it. And that controls what it does. And there are all kinds of different systems, so I'm not going to get into the specific features because they are very different. But that is the most common. Now, there are units the outside compressor units, which will run 2 to 4 of these inside units. And I have seen those advertised. I've seen houses where they've been put in. But by and large, they are the equivalent of a room air conditioner, I guess we called it when I was growing up. Except that they're heat pumps, not air conditioners. Now, I actually had, at our other house, I had a heat pump that fit in a window. It because my office was in a little shed outside in the backyard. It's called a sleep out, which is, it's got electricity. It's fully insulated and finished on the inside. And it's intended as a kid's playroom, or maybe a guest can sleep out there, those sorts of things. It's not meant as, you know, permanent accommodation, and it's easily removable, theoretically. But it got really hot in the summertime and cold in the winter. And so the summer, all I had was fans, and, well, more or less. And in the winter, I had an oil column heater, which I've already discussed. So we found this. It's like a window air conditioner, but it was a heat pump. And it worked really well. I don't know what its power usage was. It was probably shocking. But it did work really well. Now, I've never seen them since. So they were with a Carrier or York? York. They're by York. I've never seen them since. And so I don't know if they're still available in New Zealand at all, or if that was a one-off deal, or what the story is. But they just don't seem to exist anymore. And instead, people are using – they're usually called split units. And they do – one room at a time. If you get a big enough one, it can, and if your floor plan is open enough, it can cool the whole area. But in terms of a whole house system, that is really rare. Unlike, it's usually not like our house, and we're not zoned at all either. It's all or nothing. The sensor is in the cold air return, and so it sees what temperature the air coming back to the unit is, and adjusts the temperature accordingly, according to what we've set it for. And which is all well and good, you know, not a problem with that, except that the only way to control the amount of cool entering a room is to open the vent up or to close it down, which means getting on a ladder, because we have unusually high ceilings. I mean, I think these are 13 foot, 12 foot, 11 foot. I don't know. They're really high. Anyway, I can't touch them, and I can easily touch over 9 feet, I think. Something like that. Anyway, I'll measure it one of these days. I'll get back to you on that. But the final comment is from Roger Green, who said, "The wife keeps the heat lower at night than I would like. Heck, probably colder than she would like, since she complained of a cold nose in our bedroom recently. For me, it's a particular drag, because about 50% of the time I'll waken in the middle of the night and check my email or try to blog something. Oh yeah, belated happy birthday. I was distracted." Thank you, Roger, and you're completely forgiven. You certainly were distracted. And but I have a similar situation, because I don't like it. I like it cool when I'm sleeping, but not cold. And Nigel prefers it to be a bit colder than I do. And in the wintertime, I typically will wear a sweatshirt to stay warm enough. But he actually even has a fan running at night for a little extra cooling. And I wouldn't particularly care for that, although since he's going to use one anyway, I would actually prefer we had a ceiling fan installed in the bedroom rather than use this little thing sitting on the floor. But yeah, maybe it's just me. But those are all of the comments for the previous episode. And I'll keep you updated with what happens with our choices and so on. I just don't know what it's going to be. But since this episode is now coming up on nearly an hour, I don't think I will be doing another episode this week. I may not, who knows. But I did want to tell you that coming up, I'm going to be doing an episode on what, for lack of a better word, I'm calling resources, well, for now anyway. And what that's going to be about is giving you some pointers on things that you can check out if you want to know more about New Zealand politics or government or the things that I'm talking about, so you can listen and follow along all on your own. They're the sorts of things that I do to keep up with what's going on. And so I thought, since we're going into an election season that I'm going to be talking about quite a lot, that I might just pass on those resources for anyone who's interested. But that is it for today. That may be it for this week, probably, possibly, I don't know. Last week was a hell of a week, and I'm glad to get through it, but I survived for a change. Well, I may have survived. But that's it for now. I will talk to you soon. Bye.
You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amrens Podcast at amrenspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrenspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.